Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Lance Tauzer. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of interviewing Jeff Murphy from the band Shoes, live in our State of Sound studio here in the gallery. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
The setting that we're in is a little unique. We have our guests in the studio. Sometimes they're on the phone. Sometimes they're live here. What were your initial takeaways of the exhibit? I mean, you've only had like 10 minutes to walk through it, but...
I love anything music. So of course, everything is interesting to me. Growing up in the Chicagoland area, listening to Chicago radio from the time I was young, you were exposed to every different genre on the radio. That was the thing. The radio was much more, it wasn't as segmented as it is now. Back then you would hear, Motown, the San Francisco sound, the Detroit sound, the Philly sound, Chicago sound, one right after another. And so you're indoctrinated into all of that great stuff, from Stevie Wonder or Motown or what was happening in Detroit. It was all part of you. So to come in here and see the actual guitar or the actual instrument that this person played, to me, I mean, we're fans, which is why, and you are as well. Why we get into that is because we just love it. You just love being around that stuff. So I find it fascinating.
Thank you. Well, yeah, it was a labor of love for sure. And we really wanted to put on an exhibit that not only sort of told Illinois' story, make a case for what Illinois has offered the world, but I wanted it to be more than a memorabilia show. I wanted to borrow artifacts from people, specific artifacts that help tell their story. So when I reached out to you, I said, I'm doing this show. I really love to include something from Shoes. What do you have? And so maybe tell me a little bit about the artifact that you loaned us.
The Hamer guitar that's here was something that we came to be known, or we came to know Hamer guitars through Cheap Trick, seeing them in the clubs. The first time we saw Rick play a Hamer Standard, I had never seen that design before. And I literally thought that he had taken a piece of formica and a jigsaw and cut that shape out and put a neck on it. So we learned what Hamer was and came to know the guys from Hamer and started using their instruments. And in probably mid-79 then, we started to order them because they were all handmade in I think they were in Evanston at that point, or maybe they were in Palatine, I can't recall. Wherever. And so we ordered these guitars, hoping we would have them in time to do this video that we had just come back from England, but they weren't ready in time. So we owned a few, but most of the guitars that were playing in the videos were on loan from Hamer. They were less, well, yours isn't ready, but here, take this one. And so I wanted something different. I liked the different shape of it. I ordered it blue, but I wanted you to be able to see that beautiful wood grain underneath. Yeah. So it was translucent, very deep, almost a cobalt blue, and a logo that John had written on the side. We had that silk screened into the finish and laid the knobs out differently than normal. It was the first blue guitar. They had not done gold hardware, so that was something new for them at the time. And unfortunately, it didn't get finished in time for the video. But they delivered it to us on my 25th birthday back in 1979. We were playing a club called Haymakers in Wheeling,
very famous club.
Yeah, and one of the great clubs to go see a band at in the Chicago metro area back then. Mm-hmm. It was really something to have a handmade guitar and something that was designed just for you. And Gary, I know, still has a number of, we've gone through a number of guitars over the years, as we all do. You buy and you trade, you swap. But I know Gary probably still has at least a half a dozen of them. I might have two. I can't remember how many I have. But great, great company. And I really cherish it because now the company's been bought and sold, and I don't even know if they are still manufacturing under that name.
I think I think they still make Hamer guitar brands, but they're made out of China or somewhere.
Right.
So it's really just in name only,
right,
and the shape of their original. Not, I don't even know if they're doing sort of that standard or Explorer style anymore. Even.
Right. But, right.
Yeah. I mean, they are. They're a good story here in Illinois of a guitar company that sort of was going up against Gibson and some of these big and making really comparable quality guitars. And so that's pretty special is what you're saying.
Yes, it was very special. And I remember they had a factory. It must have been in Wheeling where they had it. And they were having a Christmas party that year. So they invited us to go. And there were a lot of musicians. And of course, almost everybody in the crowd was a guitar player or a bass player because that's what they were selling. And they had no drummer. So they had this setup for people to get up and jam, but they had no drummer. So my brother goes, well, I'll play. It's like, John, you don't play drums. But he knew enough that he could just get up there and play a pretty straight beat. And he got up there while these people were going and jamming on the guitars. So it was really a fun, our memory of Hamer at the time was really a fun thing.
Okay.
That's awesome. Thank you again for loaning it to us. People have really enjoyed not only your guitar, but seeing these artifacts that have such a story to tell and have such a special meaning to the artist. I'm very privileged that a lot of these artists took the time, like you did, to think about what you would loan us, and we're very much appreciative of that. My first real question about your musical background is, the band and you and yourself from Zion, Illinois, and not even really a Chicago suburb. It's so far up there.
Yeah. But it is the hub of the music industry. You have to admit that.
Well, it was for a long time, absolutely. But what was it about, you're from Zion, but what was the music scene there? Or
there was none.
Oh, okay, so there was no cult. You didn't come out of a scene or a culture. You guys just grew out of the ground and...
Yes. And, I mean, it was really Chicago radio that inspired us. And it, you know, you just say, oh, geez, I wish I could do that. I mean, and we were of an age where we were able to see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan when they first came out, which was life changing. I mean, it was, you either loved them or hated them. And one week you hated them, the next week you loved them. It was like, you know, you're young, so you're just, oh, I don't know, depending on who you were hanging around with. But they had such a cultural impact. And through the years, it just became, you judged everything musically by them. I mean, John, my brother, and I marked time by what Beatle album came out at what time. You know, we'll say, oh, yeah, I remember when, you know, 1965, December 3rd, 65, that's when, you know, Rubber Soul and We Can Work It Out single came out. It represented your life. But all music, like I said, it was such a melting pot. Chicago radio was such a melting pot of different styles that there were so many things that came out at the same time. And even though we focused on that guitar, melodic rock thing, the influences of bands like, Spencer Davis Group or whatever, have such a, you know, you just, I mean, have you heard a cooler organ than the opening of,
oh, yeah,
you know, Give Me Some Lovin'.
Give Me Some Lovin', yeah, sure.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so you carry that with you. And then we were out of high school. But John met Gary in high school and they started to be friends, and they started putting out this magazine. It was kind of like a high school version of National Lampoon. You had the official school paper and then you had what they were doing, which was, they called it Lime Magazine, which was a takeoff of Time, of course. And it was pretty, for that era, it was, I mean, you know, it wasn't obscene. Because they couldn't be obscene. Cheeky. It was cheeky. They would make fun of the faculty and personnel. And, you know,
sure.
My brother was a great cartoonist. And he would draw, like, you know, a cartoon of the janitor, you know. And it was stuff like that. So there was a clique of guys in high school, the Lime Boys, as they came to be known. And I was younger. So to me, I always hung around with the older guys because that was cool. You know,
sure.
They were cool. And John and Gary had this idea to start a band called Shoes. And I was a geek. I was into this gear and electronics and all that. I had gotten one of those little tape recorders when I was, I don't know, 8, 7 or 8 with the little reels,
Sure.
and I would record things off of TV. I just love the mechanics and the audio and all that stuff. So when TIAC introduced their first consumer level multi-track tape machine, which was the 3340, you could actually record four tracks in sync, where you could record something on each channel independently and have it all play together. So I ordered one, and that was what, that was our, I guess you'd say, our mentor. That gave the three of us the ability to experiment and learn and try to see if that works. Things that we would never have the, we're all pretty introverted when we get into a crowd. So being on stage was something we just thought we'd never do. But recording, you know, if you made a mistake, you just push that red button and it's gone. You know, no one gets to hear the mistakes.
Right.
So we learned, and taking all those influences that we had from the past, you know, the 20 years, 18 years, whatever it was, of music, and fusing it into what we could do, which is very limited. And we learned how to sing and write and play and record all at the same time.
Yeah. All right. So bands that are comprised of siblings have, in many cases, had very mixed results. The Kinks, famously, Oasis, of course. There have been some ones that worked out.
Everly Brothers.
There you go. Well, there's a classic example. Yeah. You are still in a band with your brother, your older brother. What was that sort of dynamic like? Would Gary ever get between you, or how has that all worked out?
You know, it's the structure of our band is, John is probably the most, he's kind of Switzerland, and Gary and I would usually have the strongest, opinions, and it would be I don't want to say a battle of wills, 'cause that sounds too much of conflict. Right. But I mean, if he had an idea and I had an idea, we would try to meld it together. Huh. But we were always all about one thing, and that is, we're in a three-man sack race. Nobody runs faster than anybody else. There is no leader. There's no follower. We didn't want one guy driving a Volkswagen while someone else is driving a Cadillac. So when we established our publishing company, which we did, I want to say it was in 1977, it was important to us that no matter who writes the song, it all goes into one account, and which we each own a third, and it eliminates that squabbling.
Right.
John and I went through a tragedy when we were young. Our father, I'll say disappeared, but he really left, abandoned us when we were seven. I was seven, I think. John was eight. And I think that is part of what bonded us. Because now, you know, survival, it was just he and I and my mom. And my mom wasn't working. She was a typical 60s housewife.
Right.
Didn't have a job, didn't have a car, didn't have a driver's license. And one day she lost the car because he took it. And she's got a mortgage, two kids, and no job. So you band together. And so John and I, very rare for us to have a really tumultuous disagreement or fight. I can only think of, in the last 45 years, I can only think of two where we really, really got upset with each other, which lasts about a day. You know, if I said to Gary, I'll quit this band before I fight with my brother, at the time. And that's the thing is John and I, and because we were so close together, we're a year apart. We're Irish twins.
Right.
We're a year apart. We experienced everything almost identically. So because of that, it's very easy to identify. Even now, I mean, I talk to John and Gary almost every single day. We never broke up. There have been times that we go through, I guess I'd say dormant periods.
Sure.
And a lot of it is dormant on the outside. In other words, like I'd said to you before we started taping here, is we've been working on things, recording things for, you know, since the last album came out. The most recent album was in, what was it, 2012. But that doesn't mean we're not doing something, you know, writing, recording, or at least still involved in music in some way. The big problem to us is figuring out what to do. The industry, as we knew it when we got into it back in the 70s, is completely different now. It doesn't exist. All of the, I guess you would say, we would set what we called attainable goals. At first, it was, boy, if we can just get a something recorded. And then it was like, if we could just get a record out. So we started pressing our own records. And then it was, if we can just get a record deal. And, you know, you just keep moving that carrot on the stick farther away. And all of the things that we aspired to, like getting a record out, getting songs on the radio, getting on the charts, you know, then MTV came along, being on MTV, all those things are gone. They don't have the impact. So now you have to realign and recalibrate and say, okay, what is it you want to do now? And we still love making music, but it's hard to create something that's not going to be enjoyed or used or viewed or listened to. So we struggle with that aspect of it. What?
Sure.
How do we do it? I don't know if anybody's completely figured that out yet.
No, it's as you said, it's a whole new ball game, and people are making records in their bedrooms that are winning Grammys, and
yay.
It is quite a different scene. And it seemingly, I guess maybe the mindset before was you made a record and then you went on tour to promote that record. And nowadays, people are just playing to make their money, and their music comes out willy nilly or very, you know, it isn't that formula of record, tour, or whatever, or record, promote, or whatever it is. It, like you said, there are no rules. So
everyone makes their own way, and yeah. I love it when people do things different. I was listening to NPR the other day, and I heard someone say, and I don't know if this is an exact quote, but it was they were talking about Machiavelli and saying that he said something to the effect of, if you do something new or different, you will be hated for it. And I thought, I remember when we first started, there was a lot of resentment towards us because of the fact that we weren't doing it the way everyone said that you had to do it, which right. was you get out in the club and you play and you play and you play and you play and you establish an audience. Our approach was, if I looked at my record collection at the time, the only record I can think of that I saw the band first and then I bought the record was Cheap Trick. And that was because I started seeing them in the clubs before they had a record deal.
Right.
But it made sense to us, if there's a, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
The record was, that was it for us. Mm. That's how I got to know this great arrangement, variety of music, was from hearing those records. And then I would go see them play live. And I thought, then why is it that we're supposed to go play live first? Which, like I said, we didn't have the confidence to do. And when we went on our first tour, after we signed our deal with Elektra, it was two of the most embarrassing weeks of my life. It was horrible. It was horrible. We were so green and so ignorant to things. Number one, we didn't know anyone to be in a crew.
Right.
And when you're touring, your crew, you live and die based on what right. they do. And our crew not only was, so we said to the record company, how do we get a crew? So they got a couple of people from A1 Audio in Los Angeles and flew them out to us. Well, they knew less than we did. Huh. You know, we realized we weren't being given the A-listers from the company. It was, you know, hey, who can we send to Illinois? So
who was willing to come to Illinois?
Yeah, right? Well, and it was really cold because it was, and this is another mistake. We started touring at the end of November, about this time of year.
Mm.
And it was really a cold year. And the guys get off the plane and they're wearing t-shirts and jeans. They didn't even bring coats. And it was literally, you know, we were having temperatures in, you know, 0 degrees right. at the time. So every show, there was some disaster. After the very first show, we fired the sound man. He was so bad. At the first gig, we had paid all this money to get this really nice monitor system because we were trying to do these harmonies, three-part harmonies. And at the first show, we walk up to sing the three-part, and it was the loudest feedback I ever heard in my life, so much so that I went dizzy, you know, where it screws up your equilibrium.
It rattled you, huh?
And it blew every a tweeter out of the monitors all at one time. Wham! Gone. My hearing's gone. And I was playing that Blue Hammer, I believe it was. And at soundcheck, I said to the roadie, I said, can you put some new strings on that thing? I mean, I forgot to change them. Can you change that? So he changed the strings. Well, he didn't know how, he didn't tell me, he didn't know how to restring a guitar.
Oh, jeez.
So when I, you know, lights come on, shoes, here they are. Hit the first chord and three strings literally pulled off the guitar because he didn't know that he had to go around the,
oh my God,
the tuning peg more than a couple of times. So I'm standing with a guitar with three strings on it that's screaming out of tune. The monitors are blown. I'm deaf from the feedback. And I forgot to mention this. Time Magazine was doing an article about The Who, a cover story about The Who. And the sidebar article was the second generation of rock shoes. So they sent a writer and a photographer on the tour. Oh. They are sitting watching this disaster happen. And it was, like I said, I'd recently broken up with my girlfriend, and she shows up and is sitting in the front row crying.
Oh my God.
So this was really a stressful night for me.
It's a convergence.
More than one way. So we fired the sound guy the first night. Next night, we, you know, it was just day after day of these disasters. Expensive, because back then you took your own PA on the road with you.
Okay,
so it was our gear. You know, we weren't renting this stuff, and it was just we played a place in Indianapolis. I want to say it was the Vogue Theater, and the crew, the gear flipped on its back and rolled, and it unplugged the input cables to the power amps from the crossover, and they didn't realize it. So when they turned everything on, if you ever turn an amp on when it's grounded, it blew every high frequency speaker in the PA system before we even started the show. So when we come out,
the PA system sounded like this,
which was a disaster. Nice. Wore bowling shoes, which was a mistake that night because it was a wooden stage. So I'm sliding around like I'm on ice skates, and the guy for monitors, he kept saying, turn your amps down. I'll feed them to you through the monitors. Uh-huh. Turn down as quiet as you can. So we turned our amps down, and we don't play that loud anyhow. Right. I play a Hi-Watt 50. Gary was playing Marshall 50 at the time. We had them down pretty low. Feed them to us through the monitors. We have to hear that. Right. I look over, and the microphone for Gary's amp is laying on the floor. They forgot to put it in the stand. Oh, it's laying on the floor. It was things like that. Oh, and that was the night that the bigwigs from Elektra flew in to see how the tour support was going. Nope. I said, I'm never going to get on stage again. This is it. I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Wow.
It was 2 weeks of hell.
Yeah, I mean, I met you a long time ago, but even at that point in the mid-80s, you had had enough of touring even by then. I think you used to have sort of an ethos about it that the amount of work that you guys put into making your record could never be recreated live. So why attempt it? Am I paraphrasing that?
No, that's very, very true. I mean, again, a lot of the things that we liked. I mean, I love the Beatles since the beginning. But when things really got interesting to me was when they started to craft the albums, which was from Rubber Soul on.
Right.
Sgt. Pepper, they never even played those songs live. And most of their stuff from that point was never performed live because they were weaving these songs together. That's the way we always built songs. So to try to recreate that live, you would have to be a cover band and say, Led Zeppelin was one of those examples that I think of how people listen to their records and they go, oh man, I love Led Zeppelin. But when I saw them live, they just didn't sound like it. Well, right. We got one guitar player in the band. There's one guitar, but you listen to a Led Zeppelin record, there might be four guitar parts going on at the same time, five. And that's all played by Jimmy.
Right.
But when he plays live then, he has to homogenize that into one guitar part.
Right.
That's what you do. You become a cover band for your own material and say, right, okay, what can I eliminate and what do I have to play to make it still sound like the song?
Right, because people will say, if they love the record, they will compare it to your live show no matter what. You're held to a very high standard, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Oh, and they didn't sound like their record. And you say, well, that's because you're asking, yeah, I like the Mona Lisa, but not, can he paint it in front of an audience in a mall? You know, you say,
maybe.
Yeah.
One of my favorite stories about your band, and I don't make a lot of comparisons to other bands at all, but there's obviously the very funny movie Spinal Tap, and they go through a lot of drummers. And Shoes famously have gone through. I don't know if any of them spontaneously combusted or were killed in a bizarre gardening accident or whatever the spinal.
What was that time at the Mexican restaurant?
But there's always really just been the three of you, and the drummer was sort of, and then there's Skip or whoever else. So,
well, again, Shoes, the core is still the three of us, John, Gary, and myself. I always looked at my role as sort of the George Harrison to their Lennon McCartney, because I respected, they were both older, and that was their initial concept. I was never really even asked to be in the band formally. It was through a kind of attrition, I guess you'd say.
Maybe they will sometimes.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm hoping for that invite. But because I own the gear, I had to be there for the four track.
Nice.
And so,
well done.
So you end up just working together, and I remembered when, if Gary would get upset to me, he would make comments to John like, "You got to get Jeff in line here." but it was the three of us, and when we did our first recordings together as Shoes, we didn't have a drummer, so we recorded everything that we could, and then we left one track open for hey, we know a guy from high school we used to go to school with. He's got drums. Why don't we go over to his house and see if he can put drums on it? Andy Joseph was his name. So he played on those first 10 songs that we recorded. And then the next record, I had run into, I was out of school by then, but a friend of mine from school, he was a drummer. He played in school band and everything. And I was moving out from my parents for the first time. So we decided we'll rent a flat together and we can set the band up there. So drums, literally, it was a converted garage on a concrete slab. The furnace was a space heater that was in the main, I'll call it the living room, but you could not close any of the doors. There was two doors, one to the bathroom and one to the bedroom. You couldn't close the doors because there was no ductwork. So the only heat that would get into the other rooms was if you left the doors open. And we had the recording gear in the kitchen, and the PA and the band was set up in the living room. And then we would have one guy, if we were tracking something, we would have somebody in the bedroom with a guitar, and Skip was playing drums. Oh, well, actually, I'm sorry. I was talking about Barry Shoemaker was my friend from high school.
Ah.
He was the second drummer. And Gary was in France at the time, going to school at the U of I extension in Versailles.
Oh, fun.
Studying architecture. So John and I thought, why don't we surprise him? Why don't we surprise Gary, do a whole album, and show him how serious we are about this band thing? So Barry was a great drummer, and we started recording these songs. John would come home from U of I. John was going to U of I in Champaign. So he would come home on spring break, and we would record his stuff, and then I would work on stuff on my own, and then he would come and put bass and stuff on it. And Barry played drums on that. And Barry, like I said, had been in that junior high and high school band, and he said, "Oh, yeah, we recorded an album." And I said, "What?" And he showed me this record that, you know, like the Central Junior High marching band. And at that moment, it dawned on me, you don't have to be part of Capitol or CBS or Warner Brothers to have a record. You can go to a pressing plant and get records made. Yeah. So I called. I think there were two pressing plants in Chicago at the time.
And Rainbow and I can't remember.
I don't remember what they were called.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And so I called them up. And we said, let's press up some records and send one to Gary. It'll freak him out because he's in France. You know, he doesn't know any of this. And there was a postal strike going on in France at the time, so mail was very intermittent. And we wouldn't hear from him for, you know, weeks or months at a time. And John would write back John and Gary would exchange these letters back and forth, and they were both very good caricature drawings. They would draw these pictures of Shoes on stage in front of a throng of thousands, you know, this total pipe dream thing. And, we couldn't get the records made in time, pressed up in time to surprise Gary, but we sent him a cassette. And a friend of mine printed the local newspaper in Zion. And so I had the idea and convinced him to let me come in, because I was learning how to print for a living. That's what I was kind of working in a factory, a printing shop. And we snuck in one night, and I created this whole sub newspaper, and it was all about Shoes, like this musical phenomenon coming from Zion. it was just all this crap that it was untrue. Wrote all these fake newsletters and fan letters and talking about this big show that was going to happen when Gary got back from France. And we knew Gary got the newspaper delivered to him in France. So we found his subscription, and I inserted that page. Or it was actually, I think it was a 12-page section that inserted that section into his copy of the Zion Benton News. And he said it was perfect. He said he got on the bus. You know, you picture in your mind, he gets on the bus, he's standing there, he tosses this thing under his arm, you know, and he got this cassette tape. He's like, what? And he didn't think it was us. He thought we were pulling his leg when we gave him the first, what became One of Versailles. So we were always doing things like that back and forth. We played our, when Gary came back then, we recorded something with Barry and as the drummer called Bazooka. That was the next album.
Right.
And then we played our first ever show at the Brat Stop in Kenosha.
Right.
In 1976.
Brat Stop, yeah.
Yeah. And after that show, the drummer's girlfriend wasn't real keen on him being on stage. Mm. And so he, within a couple of weeks, he said, you know, I'm not as serious about it as you guys are. I am going to move out, and you know, you can get a different drummer, which was, I mean, and Barry and I got along great. We never had any issues at all. So he went out, he was working at Camelot Music. And so we went on the hunt for another drummer, and Gary didn't really want to, but then he said, well, there's this drummer that's going out with my sister. And John went to see that band, and it was a cover band, but he said, he seems solid and straightforward and not overly showy. You know, we weren't into drum solos or spinning sticks or, you know, lighting your hair on fire. And so we had Skip come and audition, and then we drove down to Dwight, Illinois, and did our first show with Skip as the drummer there in a park pavilion. And Skip was with us then until 84, after the Elektra deal expired. Well, we were bought out of that contract. After that was over, we built our own commercial studio. And Skip, you know, drummers want to be in front of an audience. They love to be. It's a physical thing.
Right.
So we haven't had a permanent drummer in the band since Skip in 84, but we've had Mike Zelenko from Material Issue played on some stuff. Rick Menk from Velvet Crush and Choo Choo Train, he played on some stuff for us. And for the last 25 years, we've used John Richardson, who is sort of a freelance hired gun, but has been a friend. He was the younger brother of a sound man that we picked up after that really disastrous tour in 79 when everything went wrong. We found his brother as a sound man, and he saved us. He gave us confidence on the road and knew how to do things the right way. And he kept saying, you got to hear my little brother. He's great on drums. We're like, yeah. And then he called up one time and said, he's playing at Metro. I want to say, what was the band? Die Warsaw?
That's sort of an industrial band. Yeah.
They were opening.
They're featured in the exhibit.
They were opening for them. Uh-huh. And so I went down and we were like, oh man, this kid can play drums.
Yeah.
And so we've used him ever since. So we have had a bevy of drummers, no doubt.
None of them have exploded. That's good to know.
Not to the best of my knowledge.
Good to know. Well, you actually pick up on a couple of things. I want you to tell the story about how you got signed to Elektra, because you've told me that story probably 30 years ago now? Mm. Is it 30 years?
No, yeah.
I can't remember. And I've told it and probably changed it over the years because I don't know if I've sensationalized it or whatever, but there's a story about where you sent your materials into at Elektra and who discovered you / got you signed. Can you walk me through that?
Well, yeah. What happened was we kept doing what we discovered that record labels were sort of like lemmings or sheep. Where if they think there's something valuable, they all come running, and they follow that, you know. And we started, but when we finished the album Black Vinyl Shoes, which was also recorded in my living room, on that 4-track TAC, we pressed up 1,000 copies and started sending it out to the press. And the Illinois Entertainer ran the first ever review, Bill Page, and that was great. He would say, I told him, you should play it for this guy. He writes for this magazine, and he's a friend, Carrie Baker and Moira McCormick. And we came to know all these Chicago press people. Mm. And it just kept growing. And we were, it was stupid luck, dumb luck of timing where the DIY movement was happening.
Yeah, that punk rock thing.
The punk rock thing. And even though our music wasn't punk rock, the ethos of recording and doing it yourself,
right?
We were all about that. The only thing we weren't doing was turning on people's turntables and putting the record on for them. We were pressing, manufacturing, recording, writing, singing, distributing, manufacturing. We were doing every aspect of it out of my living room. So these people started smelling around. We started getting press from, there's a magazine out of California called Bump, which is run by an entrepreneur called Greg Shaw, and Greg and his wife, Susie Shaw. And they flew in to see us play, bought every copy that we had left of Black Vinyl Shoes to send overseas, and wanted us to record for his label a single. Mm. He said, the song I want you to redo is okay from Black Vinyl Shoes.
Yeah.
And being the Democratic band that we were, like I was saying, we were all about everybody being equal. When you have a two-sided record, a single,
right,
you got one guy that wrote the song on one side. What do you do on side B? Who gets the other song?
Right.
Our solution was the other two guy write the song. So Gary and I sat down and wrote Tomorrow Night together. And so that satisfied all three songwriters appearing on one single. And then we relicensed the Black Vinyl Shoes album to a label called PVC, which was part of Gem, which was the label that broke Cheap Trick, more or less. Right. Even though Cheap Trick was signed to CBS, CBS in America turned down the Budokan record. And stupidly,
right?
Because that's what they were about,
right?
And we love those guys.
Yeah.
And when that happened, that record was a hit for Gem, and it really broke Cheap Trick. So that gave that label credibility to us. So we licensed that. So that record, Black Vinyl Shoes, for us had a second life. Then it got reissued in '78, a year after we issued it, and that's when people really started to write about it. The New York Rocker and Trouser Press and these publications that were really starting to take hold. So people started coming around. One of those people was Seymour Stein from Sire Records. And Seymour flew in more than one occasion. I'm thinking two or three different occasions that he flew in. And we would go, he would say, Talking Heads are playing at Park West tonight. You want to go? We say, okay. So we'd go and check them out, and then he would kind of talk about, and we didn't really understand record deals. So we didn't know much about budgets or how things, when do we get paid? How do we get paid? You know, how do we survive from January to February?
Right.
And so we were, I won't say negotiating, but we were learning more from Seymour. And that was in January of 79. By the time, it was in late 78, early 79. January of 79, Seymour came in, we had a meeting, and he said, look, I'm flying to meet him to France. They have this music conference.
Yeah.
I'll come back, we'll talk when I get back. While he was gone, I got a call at my house, and it was Kenny Batiste from Elektra Records. He was the new vice president of Elektra Records. Elektra was not a big label. They were in terms of success and visibility because they had the car. They'd just broken the cars,
right,
you know, which was hugely successful. But they also had Queen and, I can't even think of all the bands that were on Elektra. Well, The Doors, of course, back in the day.
Yeah.
But they were considered sort of a country club label because they might only sign 15 or 20 new acts a year. But Kenny had been a local promotion guy from Detroit, and he helped break the Cars record. So that gave him the leverage to say, I want to, you know, they promoted him to head of promotion.
Right.
But he said, I really want to start signing bands. So we were the first band that he came in to see, and we were set up to rehearse and play live. We played for him. We had recorded Present Tense we had gone to an 8-track machine. We had the album completely recorded. We played that for him. We played live for him. We went to dinner. He said, There'll be tickets at the airport. Meet me in LA. Bring your lawyer. And wow. Because he wanted to sign bands. And we were the first band that he signed. It was a fantastic deal. We had veto power over the songs. We owned 100% of our publishing. They paid us 100% of the publishing. If as you know,
oh, yeah, that's a big deal.
Labels will say, oh, we'd like a discount rate or a preferred rate. And so they'd only pay you 75% of what you're supposed to get.
Right.
They will also limit you. Well, they won't limit you to how many songs you can put on a record, but they're only going to pay you for 10. So most bands only put 10 songs on.
Right.
We wanted to do the Beatle thing and have more songs on. Sure. So we wanted 12. So we had a deal. They had to pay us 100% royalty on that 12-song album. And like I said, we owned all the publishing. And we got a say on who we worked with, where we worked, what songs were on it. We had control over all that stuff. We had a budget. Every budget was well into six figures for recording. And anything that we didn't spend, we got to keep. So if we came in under budget by 50 grand,
pocket it.
You get to go to lunch, you know?
Nice.
So it was really a wonderful deal with Electra. And they're all structured like athletic deals where you have option periods. Ours was structured as a nine-album deal with a 10th album override, which was a best-of collection. And then the option periods were after every two records where they could get out or we could get out.
Mm.
And so when we got signed, then it was a parade of different producers. Where we want to? Who do you want to work with? Where do you want to go? So people were flying. I remember Chris Kimsey flew in. He was working with the Stones on, I want to say it was Some Girls. And
it'd be about the right time, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, I got to get back. I'm doing the Stones tonight. Got to go. But it was cool that these people were coming into Zion, Illinois. I mean, there was nothing in Zion. Growing up in Zion was if you took Mayberry and and threw in a religious element, then you had Zion.
Right.
Zion was founded as sort of a religious commune
right.
back in the turn of the century.
Hence the name, Zion.
Yeah, yep. I mean, as a kid growing up there, you had no idea. You didn't, you know. But then it was like, gee, how come all the stores are closed on Sunday? You know? And so there's no bars.
Right.
Which meant dry town, no yeah. clubs, which right. meant no music scene.
Right.
So yeah, the music scene was just what we heard on the radio and what we created within our own self.
So was Seymour a little ticked off when he got back from France to find out that you signed with Elektra?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a kind of a weird thing.
Oops.
I remember I was producing people years later, and I remember one of them had an interview with Seymour, and they were talking and saying, oh, yeah, Jeff Murphy from Shoes recorded this. And he said, I was going to sign them, but they were too religious. So he remembered the town and somehow confused that with us as a band.
Yeah.
But, but Seymour was there first. He seemed always, and I remember him telling us, oh, I just signed this band. He's this English band, but it's got this girl singer from America. She's from Ohio, Pretenders.
Yeah.
And he was just signing this girl from Detroit, you know, Madonna. It was that time period where he was, but he had the Ramones. That was big for us.
Sure.
Because we were huge Ramones fans. Yeah. And the Talking Heads, those were very progressive and different, which we really dug that.
Yeah. And you guys have always had that sort of connection with the critics. The person who wrote this exhibit, Dave Hoekstra, wrote for the Sun-Times for 30 years.
Right, Dave.
And we're having lots of meetings about what bands did we want to feature in the exhibit. And when Shoes came up, he said, well, I think I wrote reviews of most of their records in the Sun-Times. And
yeah.
you definitely had the critics on your side. A lot of artists put out records and they just get trashed by as either being derivative or there's not enough originality or they can see through there's not enough honesty or whatever it is. Your band has always had this regard. That must actually give you a little sense of, you know, pride about the work that you've done, that these people that hear everything coming through the mail or through the door or whatever it is, they regarded your music very favorably. That must have...
Yeah, we were always
resonated.
Incredibly fortunate, and we really felt flattered and blessed that even people that were infamous for being pretty harsh critics, we had... a lot of really good press. And of course, I mean, you know, the record label would say, well, you know, good reviews don't sell records. We said, well, you know, I don't agree with that, because a lot of the bands that we discovered early on, a lot of the bands that influenced us were because we read about them through the press. Nils Lofgren had a band called Grin, and we loved that for that album he did called One Plus One back in 1970, maybe it was. Big Star. We were buying Big Star records when they first came out.
I love Big Star.
In 72 and 74. And we would talk about Big Star at the time, 1979. Nobody knew who we were talking about. So Emmett Rhodes was another one of those people who recorded everything himself in his home studio. Those were the things we really loved and aspired to. So I think that, I don't know, we're kind of, you want people, you want to have an audience, you want to have commercial success, because of the fact that any artist wants their work to be appreciated by the largest number of people.
Sure.
And I will say that almost every band, I've worked with a lot of bands in the studio over the years, and almost every one of them, I mean, sometimes you get the, I want to be rich, man. But for the most part, you know, for the most part, people just say, I just want to keep doing this.
Right.
I just want to make enough money to just keep doing
this.
Make the next one.
Yeah.
And that's the way we were as a band. We're lucky in the sense that we still own all of our recordings, all of our publishing songs, all of that, which that was another thing about our Elektra deal, was we had a secret clause put in at the time. And they literally, it was so secret and different for them that they did not want it part of the original contract, because they said, we want to honestly say that we've never put this in a contract before. Wink, wink. So it was a side letter. And what the side letter said was, if for some reason your music goes out of print off of our label, the rights to license revert back to you.
Right.
So basically,
which is, no one ever does that.
We had our control over our masters. This is in 1979. Wow. So even though our deal with Elektra was severed in 1983, I'm thinking, early 83, late 82, number one, they had to buy us out of the remainder of the contract. So we took that money and built our own commercial studio.
Right.
But also, 5 years later, when CDs became the medium that people were rebuying their record, the entire collections to, we wrote them Elektra a letter. And we said, we know that our music has been out of print for 5 years. We'd like the tapes back. Please read this section of this side letter and send us our tape. And they sent us everything back. I mean, not even just the two-track masters, the 24-track church tapes that we recorded in England and the ones we did in Los Angeles. So we got all these tapes back. And we were like, yeah, jackpot. So we started releasing on Black Vinyl Records, our own label again, CDs. And this was in 1987.
Yeah.
And at that point, independent distribution and independent record stores were happening. I mean, that was great. And we, you know, you could sell 10,000 units of almost anything without breathing hard, because people wanted stuff to play on this new format.
Right.
So we started releasing our back catalog and our new releases as well. Mm. And we released for the first thing on CD from at that point, then our studio was 16 track. We recorded an album called Stolen Wishes we finished it at the end of 1989, but we intentionally held it back until January 2nd. So that we could literally say it was released in the 90s, because we thought, wow, you know, it sounds too old world if you say 1980s, but if you say 1990.
Yes.
So on January 2nd, we started literally stuffing envelopes with this new record. And once again, the press really reacted well. It got a 4-star review in Rolling Stone. That really helped perpetuate, and that's what keeps you going, even when you're having a downtime, or you have a crisis of confidence, as I call it.
Sure.
It's nice to feel that people do appreciate what you've done.
Yeah, I mean, I think your career could really be seen as having that second act that a lot of artists do not have. If you're lucky enough to get signed, that's wonderful. And I know from personal experience that just because you get signed doesn't mean much of anything. No. But the fact that you guys made these smart decisions and signed a really good deal meant that you had this opportunity for this sort of second act.
Right.
And so before we sort of leave the Elektra years behind and talk about your second act, the fact that you guys signed this record and started making records right at the beginning of sort of MTV and that, I mean, if someone were to sort of, I'm essentially asking you to sort of summarize a little bit about that period. We've covered the sort of disastrous live beginnings.
Yeah.
But how do you sort of compartmentalize in your mind with regards to what that experience was like? Because not everybody's experience is the same. And you're obviously a fairly unique. But if you were to look at the Elektra years and say, well, this is really what I take away from that, how would you kind of respond to that?
You know, it was the best and the worst years of our lives. We did an interview. We did a Zoom cast recently with all of us on. And the interviewer held up the cover of different records and said, give me one word that defines this. Uh-huh. And, you know, you as an artist yourself, you know that people tie music to a specific time or event in their life. If it fits well in a movie, they remember that visual, which is why MTV is kind of a difficult thing, but because it locks you into an image instead of their own imagination.
Sure.
But to us, the best of times was the fact that we had this. I mean, we're touring the world. My God, we're doing promo tours. We're going to the coasts. We're recording. We recorded the second album. The first album we did in England with Mike Stone, who had worked famously with Queen. And then we mixed at Trident Studio, which is where the Beatles did Hey Jude,
oh, yeah.
And where Bowie did Ziggy Stardust, and T-Rex did Electric Warrior. And that's the piano that McCartney played on Hey Jude. And we're like, oh, you know, just to be in the same room as these
right.
things. And then we recorded the second album with Fleetwood Mac's production team. We worked with Richard Dashett, who had worked on Rumors and Tusk. And we just happened, we had been in LA and we were going to see this band at the Whiskey called Great Buildings, I think they were called. But two of the guys became the Rembrandts.
Mm.
And so we went backstage before the band played to say hi, just introduce ourselves. And there's a bunch of people backstage at the Whiskey and we're all mingling and talking. And I looked over and I recognized Richard sitting in a chair. And we had wanted him on the first album, but he was busy doing Tusk. And so I, you know, walked over and introduced myself and the band started. So it was really loud. And I thought he said, how long are you in town for? Or no, I thought he said, how long are you in town? Or have you been in town? And I said, only a couple of days. When actually he had said, how long are you here for? And then when I heard, I said, oh, we're looking for a producer. So, you know, we're all standing around and he was funny. We had a great sense of humor and
very important.
You have to. Mike Stone, same thing. You know, it was all about Monty Python with Mike Stone. And so when we were working with Richard, I mean, literally, we would be having lunch and Richard would say, shoot me. So you go, bang, and he'd literally fall with his face into a plate of spaghetti just to make you laugh. But so he invited us out to his house. In Malibu, we went out there and partied. John wrecked his moped.
Oh dear!
At the first meeting, which we thought might not bode well, but Richard thought it was funny. So we started recording with Richard. So it was. I said we had these, and we worked at what became Ocean Way, but it was at the then, and I think now again it's called United Western, which is where Mamas and the Papas and the Beach Boys and all these great things were done again.
Wow.
So you have all these really fantastic memories of being in these places and doing these things. But then you have the downside of knowing that the reason that we had videos was because we had worked in England and we could see video was years ahead of where America was. Mm. They had video shows.
We
had Midnight Special, you know, it was still people lip syncing, acting like they're playing live.
And the old gray whistle test. Top of the Pops. They had all that.
And they were very into videos.
Yeah.
Where America hadn't quite figured that out yet. So when we came home, we recorded four videos. We taped four videos in one day. Pretty straightforward band standing performance style videos.
Yeah.
Which thank God for that, because in retrospect, it would be pretty cheesy to be, you know, trying to be an actor. You know, I mean, it's very uncomfortable. None of us are comfortable in front of cameras.
Right.
And to be in a video of your song where you're aping.
Interpreting it.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it locks people into a mindset. You want people to interpret in their own way.
Sure.
So it was great times. It was ugly at the end because the MTV thing was, once it happened, we would go into Elektra and say, come on, look at this mail. Look at this. They're saying it's no big deal. MTV is a flash in the pan. Wow. We're not going to finance any more videos. And that was the end. So it was
short-sighted.
Short-sighted. Very much so.
So, you make the smart deal when they buy you out of your Elektra deal, you use the money to build a studio. And I'm assuming the idea was to use it to record your own stuff, but also to make some money. And you begin to attract bands from the Chicago area and others. I'm kind of telling your story for you. Why don't you jump in?
Well, then take it from there. It wasn't even the thought of recording other bands wasn't really thought of initially.
Oh.
We built it as our own studio. Again, you know, being Beatle fans, like the Beatles built their studio in the basement of Apple. We thought, let's build our own place, because we always had a studio. I mean, that was before there was a band, we had something to record on.
Right.
So we needed to have that clubhouse. We needed to have that central point of getting together. So we built initially a 16-track studio not far from where Gary and I lived in the same apartment complex, and it was very, very close by. And we built that in 83. But then... We were recording our album Silhouette, which was a very experimental record. It was the album previous to it. We had used two 24-track tape machines synchronized together, so we had 46 tracks of usable recording. Now we went to 16-track, so it was a different mindset. We had to think differently. Okay, we got to pare down. We have to get creative. We were experimenting with different. We brought in a keyboard which we had never really used before. So it was, after we finished that album, there was a lot of downtime at the studio. It's just sitting, all this gear. Why not hire it out to bands?
Right.
So we started, we put an ad in the Illinois Entertainer and started getting people coming up from Chicago, which really was surprising because we didn't expect that. We thought it would be the local musicians.
Mm.
And I did do a single. That was another one of those things where there was a local band literally from Zion that came in, and they were called Perfect Stranger.
Okay.
And I was saying to them, well, this is, you know, what we did. Why don't you guys do a single? I'll show you how to press it up. And so we recorded, and I think it was like we needed to pay the rent that month. So I said, look, give me $600 and I'll give you a single. You know, that's kind of how it started. So they came in, you know, we spent, I don't know how many days, 2 or 3 days recording. And now what do we do? I said, well, you design a single sleeve, which was awful.
You mean John didn't do it for him?
No, it was terrible. So, but anyhow, I said, you press it up. Here's the pressing plant, press it up. And they did, they released it. And they said, now what do we do? I said, send it out to the press. Try to get an audience. Right. Well, Chris Morris from Billboard, it's his... recommended single of the week.
No kidding.
In Billboard. I said to those guys, you don't understand what this means. This is the first thing you guys have ever done. And there's people at record companies losing their jobs right now because you guys got the recommended single and they didn't.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, eventually the band just kind of imploded. But then we started getting other people from the area doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it just kept growing and people were, and so as a studio, we never lacked for work. We were lucky. We always had people coming in. And eventually, I don't remember when it was, but it was 85 when Material Issue started working?
Yeah, 85.
That was at the old studio when it was 16-track.
Right. 16-track, just much, the 1-inch, whatever that was.
Yeah, yeah. Tascam 80,
I don't 80, know how 85, 16B.
85, 16B.
He knows all the numbers.
Yeah. sorry, I'm a geek.
Butch. Brilliant geek, though.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, that's how we met. I was in Material Issue, and Jim was a champion of shoes and really wore the band. I mean, literally had a sticker on his guitar.
Yes.
Was a big champion of the band. And he wanted to record at your studio. And I was just along for the ride. So this is not my story. This is your story. But I experienced what it was like to drive from Chicago or the Chicago suburbs where Jim and I lived and come to Zion.
That's a long drive.
It's a, you know, it's a hike, but it is what, and you had this studio that was kind of long and narrow, mm-hmm. that I recall.
Yep.
Memories.
Yeah.
All there still, but I think it was, for us, there's lots of recording studios in Chicago, but he felt comfortable in this space. He felt comfortable with you specifically. And he wasn't an easy guy to get along with.
I think Jim and I, and like you said, Jim was a Shoe fan, which was great. But even deeper than that was our taste in music was very similar. Aside from, you know, the fact that he knew our music was the fact that if he went back, he liked, and he didn't care if it was cool.
Oh, no.
He liked the song by the Troggs.
Right.
Or he liked the song by the Grassroots. He didn't care if it was hip. And that I respected him so much for the fact that I knew he was going to take crap for that because of the fact that, oh, that's not cool. That's not punk. That's not street.
Right.
But he didn't care. If he liked it, Sweet. Right. He was a huge Sweet fan.
Oh, my gosh. Well, of course, they recorded
with Mike Chapman eventually. Yeah. But I think that was the thing. We had a mutual appreciation of things. It's funny you mentioned that Shoe sticker that he had on his guitar on the album cover. The label whited it out.
I know they did. I think he was mad about it too, right?
Yeah. They whited out where it said Shoes.
I know.
But if you have the 12-inch single, it's still, they left it on that. Yeah. They left it on that. But that was and Jim was a great salesman for the studio because you know how Jim was. If Jim was into it, it was the coolest thing in the world.
Absolutely.
So Jim advertised for us just by to his musician friends.
Sure.
And would say, you guys got to go up and work with Jeff up at
Shore. Everybody in town. He was this type of person who really wanted to be a part of that community. And even though he was making pretty much straight ahead poppy music, he wanted to be a part of that alternative scene or that punk scene or whatever. He wanted that credibility. Famously, one of the covers that Material Issue did when I was in the band was Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town by Kenny Rogers in sort of a punk rock way. And I think we only know 2/3 of the song. There was a bit that we just, you know.
He did the boxer that way too.
He did the boxer the same way, yeah.
He knew about four lines of the song and then we
truncated versions, yes. Yeah. So he was a good, but you then tapped into this, you know, this scene and artists started to come to Zion and the studio kind of came, kind of a business. What was that like?
It became, I mean, I that's all I did then besides Shoes and producing other people. And it started to get, for me, what I had said to you earlier today was that when I worked with a band, I would do everything I could to make it sound like a record. That's what they always say, make it sound like a record,
right?
Whatever that is. So regardless of how prolific they were or how much money they had, I always tried to make, and that's part of the problem that we had with the studio was I could never let it go. I couldn't just bring in some guy that was training and have him fill the hours from 2:00 to 6:00 in the morning because I wanted the reputation of the studio to be consistent and I wanted everyone to get the best possible. And I couldn't let go of the studio to do that. So if I wasn't there, no one was working. Mm-hmm. But Jim would talk to these people and I would get all these bands that would come in and work I loved it. And like you said, it's funny because I guess they call it power pop, but pop music, melodic rock, whatever you want to call it, is kind of the bastard child of punk and of rock music because it's looked down upon as being fey or cheap or cheesy. And you just go, you know, in my book, Foo Fighters are power pop. Tom Petty is power pop.
Oh, yeah.
Fleetwood Mac is power pop, at least Lindsay's songs. Right. You know, so to me, it's a very wide shovel. And like I had said earlier, the Beatles, you take Helter Skelter, that wouldn't really fit into most people's definition of power pop.
No.
And neither would the song Yesterday or Blackbird. But Blackbird and Helter Skelter appear on the same album. That is that's the problem with, I guess you would say, definitions.
Sure, categories.
Categories. Yeah. This is the pigeonhole that you see. Nobody neatly fits into it, you know, because then if they do, it's boring. They float in and out of it. The last album that we did Ignition.
Yeah.
I don't want to say the last because it makes it sound like we're not going to do another. But a most recent album that we did, we had a song on there, which was the last song we recorded for the album, was called Hot Mess.
Yeah, which is a rock tune.
It was fun. We had
Wait,
so
who's
much
singing
fun.
That one? Is that you?
It depends. John's singing the verse.
You guys are known for your sort of schoolboy, and whoever's singing that is...
I'm singing the chorus.
Is that right? Oh, yeah. Man.
I'm singing the chorus.
It's hardcore.
And yeah. John's singing harmony. And it was one of those things where we're literally... The album was done. We had 14 songs ready. And then Gary goes, look, I know we don't need another song, but I got these chords. What do you think? And he had done some chords to a drum track. And I said, plug me in. I know what I'm going to do. And literally, he plugged me in. I heard in my head what I wanted to play. And as I'm sitting in the control room, you know, and we had the amp, the head in the control room and the amp in the other room, the bottom mics. And as I'm playing along, John is sitting next to me, writing lyrics and the melody. He says, I know what I'm going to sing. And it came together that quickly. And John's lyrics were filthy, but funny. And that was the whole point. He was trying to make us laugh.
Right.
And I came home. Lori, my wife, said when I got home at like 2 a.m, she said, you were still laughing when you got home from the studio that night. And we caught slack for that because it didn't fit into that power pop category. You said, that's more Stonesy.
Right.
I said, hey, man, I'm as much, I grew up on the Stones as much as I did the Beatles. So that's all in there. It's just a matter of when it comes out.
Right. And, I mean, we made a point in the exhibit that power pop as a subgenre of rock, if you want to say,
yes,
was worthy of making a separate section, only because I guess we're making the argument that it was sort of Midwest grown, that sort of don't bore us, get to the chorus, that, you know, that super hook type stuff that Cheap Trick championed initially. And you guys, of course, carry the torch. You guys have had to kind of carry that label. I'm imagining at the time when you're first making your first records, you're not thinking, oh, I think this is a really good power pop tune. That term really wasn't
used
at the time, right?
For us, it was, we want to hear more of this. This is what we love. This is what we want to hear more of. Right. I want to hear more of that Paperback Writer kind of, to me, that was sort of the beginning of that feel of that kind of slightly grungy guitar, you know, because that's 1966. And yet this cool melody, a little bit of techno craft on top of there with the slap echo and Paperback Writer. It had all the elements for me as a listener to just hook me in, and Rain, the flip side. Right. To me, that was the beginning of power pop.
Sure.
But in general, we wanted to make music that we liked. This is what I want to listen to, so this is what I want to give to everyone else. Right. There was no... at the time, Todd Rundgren was a big influence on us. And the album Something Anything, where he recorded everything himself on the first three sides, that's right in our wheelhouse.
Right.
But a lot of that wouldn't be considered power pop either, even though Couldn't I Just Tell You is one of the absolute classic power pop songs.
Right.
A song like Slut, maybe not so much, but it's on the same album. Right.
Yeah, and so I have checked in with you over the years, and there's been long gaps between, and I remember touching base with you. I can't even remember what it was, but you were full of juice because you had this opportunity to go to Japan sort of later in your career, and I'm using finger quotes, but, you know, again, this is a scenario where you're living, I guess at the time you're in Wisconsin now, or maybe you weren't in,
right.
I can't remember where you were living.
We'd all moved just slightly across the border into Wisconsin.
Right. And so, you know, you had this opportunity to go to Japan. And I mean, that just doesn't happen. You've got, you're living your life, you're doing your stuff, and you have your dormant phases, and suddenly, how did this come about? What was that experience like?
You know, the wonderful thing, I've said to my wife, Lori, several times, one of the things I love about making music is that musicians are some of the nicest people. And they're so giving. And we became friends with Al Chan, who was the bass player in the band The Rubinews from
Berserkly Records.
From San Francisco.
Them.
And so we were, he got a great voice. That boy, he can sing. Anyhow, we were conversing back and forth, and he said, hey, the Rubinews just got back from Japan, and they love you guys over there. Why don't you go over and do a tour? And I said, well, that sounds like fun. And see, that's the thing about shoes is it's not that we're anti-live. It's just that something has to be fun. Or there's we always say there's one of three reasons to do it. Either it's something we've never done before, and it's fun and an experience, or there's some kind of career advancement in some way. This fell into the category of never done it before and fun. Yeah. And so he hooked us up with the guy that put their tour together, and the guy says, oh, I would love to have you guys come over. He said, and the deal was, I mean, it's expensive to get just to get over there.
Right. Yeah.
So he said, we pay all your expenses. We put you up in hotels. You get 100% of the merch, but we can't pay you for the show itself.
All right.
I said, well, so you sit down and you go, well, the hotels would be this much for a week, and the merch was going to be this much, so, and the flights are going to be this much. So, yeah, we'll take that deal.
Right.
You know.
So no matter how many people show up to your show, you're okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was... And it was fantastic.
That's awesome.
It was fantastic. I mean, it wasn't Budokan or anything, but it was wonderful. The people were so nice. I got home. I said to my wife, it renewed my faith in humanity when I see, I said, you know, I've been to New York a number of times, this was my first time in Tokyo. I said, we're there for a week. I never heard one horn honk. And really? I laughed and said something to our host, and he goes, oh, that would be considered rude.
And?
Yes. So it's one of those things where it was reinvigorating in so many ways. As a band, it was a bonding thing between the three of us again to do something together. So all in all, it was just, you know, and those are the things that happen. Even the most recent show that we did, we played at the Arcata Theater in St. Charles, which is, we don't play in Illinois that often, but, and that came up because when we had been asked to play at the 40th anniversary, for the, Trouser Press magazine. They were having a party a couple of years ago, and they said, hey, Dwight Twilley's going to headline on Friday night. Would you guys want to headline on Saturday?
Oh, that's awesome.
And we said, sure, because Ira Robbins, who was the publisher of the publication, was a big supporter and fan. So we said, sure, Ira, for you, we'd absolutely. So we went and did that, and we were staying at the same hotel as Dwight, and he said, we should do a show together. Well, 3 years later, he was doing a show in Illinois and said, hey, we're going to play it at the Arcana. You guys want to play too? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I love Dwight Twilley. Salt in My Tears, great, great tune. I mean, he's got a great voice too.
Dwight?
Dwight Twilley.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm on Fire. What a great, you know, great power pop tune.
Yeah, super great. So you talked a little bit about already that you're constantly recording or occasionally recording or however it's working in your normal lives now. It's been a while since Ignition came out. You know, you already talked about how you really don't know what to do, if I'm going to press you to say, you know, other than doing that, what are your hopes? What would you like to do?
We all three of us definitely want to get some new shoe music out there. Conflict is how do we do it? Do we do a song at a time, which is great and perfect for a band like us that records, you pop it up and have it downloaded and streamable tonight.
Right.
But it doesn't satisfy that three-writer thing,
right,
that we try to maintain. So we've talked about, I suggested a couple months ago that we do not an LP, not an EP, a 3P, you know, where we have like three songs, one by each of us.
Uh-huh.
I know that Gary, Gary Cleet, yes, the other guitar player, has a complete solo album ready, recorded. He's got a video for it. He just has not released it because of this issue. And
you've already done a solo record.
I've done a solo in the past. Yeah. I did one when we sold our studio, the 24-track studio, in 2004 because we could see the digital revolution
writing on the wall.
Yes, we could see that. And we decided to sell, and now that gear is worth so much more money, all the analog gear we had.
Oh, wow.
But now you can record that stuff at home. Right. So Gary installed a studio at his house. I installed a rig at my house. And the first thing we did was a Cheap Trick song. We thought it'd be fun. We were asked to do something for a tribute album, but the album never really came to fruition. But we went ahead and did the song sort of as an experiment to see, can we record at home again? Did some files at my house. Gary did some stuff at his house.
Nice.
We brought it over, flew it in. I've still got flying faders at my house. I mean, I'm a tactile guy.
Yeah.
But and so I mixed it at home, and we released that in that was 2007. Mm-hmm. And there's one of those in there too, by the way.
Awesome.
It was an experiment to see, does this digital thing work? Can we do this? Can we bounce things back and forth?
Yeah.
And recently, there's been a lot of that going on. I mean, we've been doing tracks for other people. I'm Matthew Sweet's bass player, when he tours, Paul Chastain and I have been doing some things together. He's in Japan. As a matter of fact, quarantined in Japan now because they're not allowing people in or out.
Oh, boy.
But we've been sending files back and forth and doing a couple songs. I think we've got, I don't know, maybe two or three that we've got done or close to it. And my friend Bill Kelly out in L.A., same thing. He's been sending tracks back and forth.
Right.
I was in Elmhurst College a couple of weeks ago recording for a friend of mine who used to be a professor at Harper College.
Yeah.
I would go down and speak during his Beatle class. He would have a Beatle class and ask me to talk. And he has a band called Athenor, which is sort of a kind of a 70s feel throwback folk psychedelic pop.
Oh, wow.
Which I love all that stuff.
Sure, like. Sure.
So he asked if I would sing and play. So went into Elmhurst College, the studio down in the basement.
That's my alma mater, by the way.
Yeah, and we recorded a couple songs. That's coming out shortly.
That's fun.
I just did a track, contacted from some guy from Romania who's a Shoes fan and said his mother was a big Shoes fan and turned him onto it. And now his thing was, and he said, she's died, unfortunately, in the meantime, but I want to do this as a tribute, and would you play on one of my songs? I said, sure. You know, so he sent me some tracks and did that.
Oh, that's lovely.
So there have been a lot of little things going on. I re-released the book that I had written about being in England and recording that first album and the early days of Shoes.
Right.
It was the 40th anniversary of that recording, so I reissued that book as both an e-book and a hard copy. I released that. It's on Amazon. And last week, I don't know if you know the band The Flash Cubes.
I'm familiar, yeah.
Tommy Allen just said, hey, we're going to do as a band, we're going to do a bunch of cover songs that we were influenced by. One of those songs is Tomorrow Night by Shoes.
All right.
Would you would you be up for maybe you guys doing background vocals on it or give me that guitar solo sound that you had on the original? I said, sure, send the tracks over. That'd be fun.
So you're doing this all in the cloud, or they send you the files, large file transfer, or whatever it is they're doing. And
Dropbox.
And it all works with your software and their software somehow. Okay, yes. That's just marvelous.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about digital is it allows you to do so many things that you could never do before. One thing that I just did recently, one of the guys that was on our road crew had been in a prog rock band. And I remember distinctly recording that band, and they had a song that was 20 minutes long.
As you do when you're in a prog rock
band. Yeah, and they were in the studio, but at the time, Lori was getting a little upset the fact that I was spending so much time in the studio, and she goes, you say you're going to be home at 6, and you don't get home till 8. I said, I'm going to try. So we made dinner plans with this other couple. I said, I promise you, I will be out by 6 so we can go to dinner.
Okay.
Well, now I'm mixing this 20-minute song for this prog rock band, and I can look at the clock, it's 5:30, and I'm, okay. And I had to do it in one pass. You know, it wasn't like, oh, go back at middle section. It was like I had to remember all these moves because it was before automation and all that stuff. So I mixed this 20-minute song in one pass. I literally said, okay, that's it. Thanks, guys. Leadered the tape, cut it to them, gave them, and they walked out because I had a session the next day. Everything was going to be struck.
Right.
There was no way. It was like, come back tomorrow and we'll finish. It was finish it right. And so I called the guy up and I apologized. I said, look, and he says, man, I don't even remember. It sounded great to me.
And you made dinner.
Yeah. Well, and I got to dinner at the same time. But I was really, it bothered me all that. I mean, that was, 30 years ago.
Well, thank you again for doing this, Jeff. It's been lovely to revisit some of these shared memories. But
thank you, Lance.
I've been a fan of Shoes forever, and it's been a big part of. It was, when we set about to do this exhibit, we knew that we wanted to tell these stories. And I think part of what we want to do, if people walk in and they're not fans or they don't even know the music genre, the idea was to open their eyes a little bit. Make them feel, if they're from Illinois, give them a sense of pride. Oh my God, I never knew all these bands were from Illinois. And if they're not familiar with it, give them a discovery opportunity to go and listen to it on Spotify or however they get their music now. And And for us, it's I see it purely as a celebration of the music from our state. And in many cases, you know, there are music genres that don't fall into rock and roll, and that's fine because I think music is subjective, like we've been talking about. And I may very well, you know, connect to a particular type of music, but being exposed to this type of things, I think the idea of making a little backstage journey through our space, and right now the idea was you sort of emerged the back door, and the patron experience is that actually we have a crowd noise sound effect as you leave the backstage, as if you're entering sort of life stage, and we have a big mural of a crowd greeting you as you exit this backstage space. And that was kind of what we were hoping. We were hoping that we were sort of arming these people with this story and these stories of music from Illinois to take with them, you know, when they go. And so thank you so much for loaning us the artifact and sharing your story and being sort of a part of our exhibit.
It's my pleasure. I mean, even though bands of all sorts get segmented, like we were talking about earlier, we all really are the same in the sense that we have that, you have that in your blood, that you just want to make music. You love making music. I mean, even if it's not something that you're known for, if it's more, rap or R&B or it's more Stones than Beatles, who's not going to pick up a tambourine and play along if they get the opportunity with whatever genre? You just love it as a person that appreciates music. And so it's fantastic to see it all in one location.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.